Not exactly. But you do know John 117's real age. Nyato sighed and shot a glance toward John. Sorry, son. Halsey's jaw fell. John, you didn't tell—
Of course not, ma'am, John said. He had a friend who trained against us on Reach. Commander Nyato worked out our age from there.
Ascot's glare remained fixed on Nyato.
Is that so?
It was just scuttlebutt, Nyato said. I didn't realize he was breaching security, or I would have shut him down.
We'll worry about your friend's security violations later, Ascot said. Just give me the math.
Nyato looked at the tabletop and sighed. I had a buddy who used to get his unit's butt rightly kicked when training against a bunch of 8-year-old kid mandos on Reach, he said. He was bellyaching about it 7 years ago. So, when you add it up, the kid mandos would be about 15 now.
Halsey leaned forward, placing her upper body between Ascot and Nyato, then asked,
And what makes you think these kid mandos, as you call them, are my Spartans?
It was a clever move, John realized, designed to make Nyato feel shielded from Ascot and reinforce the out she was giving him. From what he had said so far, there was no way he could be certain the children his friend described had grown up to become Spartans. But apparently, Nyato was not comfortable deceiving his superior. He merely nodded at John, then said,
Spartan 117 has a lot of skills, but lying isn't one of them. I had him pegged as one of those kid mandos the first time he denied it.
So figuring this out was just an accident? Avery Johnson asked. He was staring down the length of the table, watching Nyato with unblinking attention.
Just one of those things that comes up in a conversation?
Yeah.
Nyato met Johnson's gaze evenly.
How'd you find out?
Who says I did?
Avery flashed a tight smile that left John wondering what he was missing between the two men.
I'm not even sure I believe you.
Nyato shrugged.
Fine with me, he said. I didn't want to tell anyone their age anyway.
But you did. Halsey looked around the table, then added, And it's an unfortunate disclosure that can't leave this room.
I can see why you wouldn't want it to, Crowther said. But deploying child soldiers is a violation of about 6 articles of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. When the Judge Advocate General hears about this, you're going to confinement for a very long time, Doctor.
The Spartans are the UNSC's best hope of stopping the aliens, Halsey said. Do you really think my superiors will let the Judge Advocate General hear about this?
Is that a threat, Dr. Halsey? All right, that's enough.
Ascot shot them each a warning scowl, then turned her gaze on John. She spent several moments studying his 2-meter bulk, no doubt trying to reconcile his size and physical development with that of a 15-year-old boy. Finally, she exhaled and seemed to conclude there might be some aspects of the Spartan program she was better off not knowing.
I'll discuss the legal aspects with Admiral Stanforth personally, but outside this room, no one breathes a word about the Spartans' age. Clear?
Crowther's face reddened, but he said,
Very well. As long as I'm allowed to take it into consideration when making assignments, I won't be a party to sending children into combat.
They're not children, Halsey retorted. That should be rather obvious from looking at them.
Nevertheless, Colonel Crowther will have autonomy over his personnel assignments.
Ascot paused, then added,
I'm not quite sure what you've involved us in, Dr. Halsey, but until I am, we'll be playing this by the book. And losing the war.
Halsey's voice was bitter, and John shared her sentiment. The Spartans were being excluded from the operation, not because John had made a mistake, but because their true age gave Crowther an excuse to sideline them. He just hoped Halsey was wrong about the consequences. Humanity's destruction seemed a high price to pay for one man's vanity.
Ascot's reply was surprisingly calm. I hope you're wrong, Dr. Halsey, but it's my decision to make.
Then you should reconsider.
I won't.
Halsey sighed.
Of course not.
John's stomach sank, and he sneaked a glance toward Johnson, half expecting to find a gleam in the sergeant's eye that suggested he had already figured a way around Ascot's decision. Instead, all John saw were arched brows and soft eyes, a battle-hardened soldier watching him as if John had just taken a Vulcan round to the gut, as if all that remained was the bleeding out. It was a look of pity. John snapped his gaze away. That was the last thing he wanted from Avery Johnson. Hector Nieto seemed to be the only soldier in the room who respected him and his Spartans, who could see beyond their age and enhancements to what they really were. But Hector Nieto did not command Task Force Yama. Halima Ascot did, and if she wanted the Spartans to stand down, then that's what would happen. They were soldiers, even if only three people in the room actually realized it. And soldiers obeyed orders. Just when John was starting to think the long silence meant the meeting was drawing to a close, Dr. Halsey gave another disgruntled sigh and looked past Ascot to address Crowther. "Now that you've secured your scapegoat, Colonel," she said, "perhaps we should examine the underlying reason for Alpha Company's high casualty rate." "By all means, Doctor." Crowther's tone was surprisingly open. The initial situation certainly wasn't John's fault. The initial situation was a mess. Avery Johnson's tone was reasonable but firm. Alpha Company was going to take casualties dropping into that. There's no way around it.
Precisely.
Halsey nodded toward Nieto. As the lieutenant commander pointed out earlier, whether or not the insurrectionists were expecting us, they were certainly ready.
"I'm not sure I see the distinction," Ascot said. "Expecting means they knew we specifically were coming," Nieto said. "Somebody would have had to tell them before we entered slipspace."
"That's hardly impossible," Johnson said. "The innies have spies everywhere."
"Which is why we take extraordinary precautions with movement orders," Ascot said. "The number of people who knew we were headed to Biko was substantial, but the number who knew we intended to stage out of the Seoba ice quarry? I can count that number on my hands."
"I didn't even know myself until we were in system," Nieto said, "and the orders came with a calm lockdown directive. No way anybody on Seoba knew we were coming."
It seemed to John the discussion was focusing on the wrong thing. Even if the insurrectionists had known that Task Force Yama intended to stage out of the ice quarry, it didn't make any sense for them to be there when the prowlers arrived. Alpha Company might have had a 32% casualty rate, but between KIAs and captures, the insurrectionists had suffered a 100% rate. If they had known a task force full of crack space assault troops was headed their way, why would they have stuck around to take that kind of punishment?
Simple answer. They wouldn't have. But John kept his thoughts to himself. He was keenly aware that most of the people at the table now saw him as nothing more than a supersized version of the Kid Mando from back on Reach, and he didn't want to say anything that might contribute to that impression. At least not until it grew clear they couldn't figure out the situation themselves.
"What about intercepts?" Ham asked. "Anything there to suggest they knew we were coming?"
Ascot shook her head. "They were keeping their comm traffic light," she said. "We intercepted a few unattributed comm clicks and some encrypted line-of-sight messages, mostly from a few supply transports they were using as recon boats. It's obvious they were mapping guards' positions, but there was no alert from the quarry about us. Just a couple of standard acknowledgements and a directive about the next surveillance target."
"So when did they realize an attack was coming?" Halsey asked.
"If they were good, when we started to jam their outgoing communications," Ascot said. "Their operators nearly broke through before Commander Nieto downed the antenna, so I'd say they were decent. They probably sounded the alert right after we started jamming."
"Perhaps you could put that in chronological terms," Halsey suggested, "for those of us who aren't intimately familiar with the timing of an insertion run."
Ascot smiled.
"Of course.
The jamming would have started on final approach, about 5 minutes out."
Halsey looked surprised.
"That little?"
"The sooner the jamming starts, the longer you need to hold it before taking out the comm facilities," Ascot said. "5 minutes is about the maximum you can count on."
"More to the point, it's plenty of time for a unit to reach its gunnery positions," Crowther said, "but only if those positions are pre-assigned and the personnel have been well drilled."
"Of course.
5 minutes isn't enough time to build those bunkers, Ham added, or even to move the Vulcans into position. Those defenses were prepared long before the Innies knew we were coming. Probably even before we knew we were coming. Silence filled the room, and John tried to be patient and avoid looking bored. They were thinking from the top down, like the officers and intelligence operators they were, and he had studied enough planning histories to know that their approach usually produced good results, sooner or later. "What about after the jamming started?" Halsey asked. "How soon did they start firing on you?"
"Right after we launched against the comm center," Nayeto said, "and it was fast. Our second missile hadn't even hit before they opened up with those Vulcans."
Ascot frowned. "They didn't fire on you during approach?"
"That's what I just said," Nayeto said. "Not until we launched."
"Then why did you miss?" Nayeto flushed and dropped his chin.
"We didn't miss, exactly," he said. "We just didn't score a direct hit."
"And that's a miss," Crowther said.
What he didn't say, though his tone made it clear, was that Nayeto's miss had cost the lives of a lot of Alpha Company soldiers.
"Why was there no second run?"
"There was a second run. When we came back to finish the drop." Nayeto was starting to sound testy.
"That's when we lost the Ghost Star."
Another pause settled over the table, and John began to wonder how long it would take them to reach the obvious conclusion. The insurrectionists had been expecting someone. Just not the UNSC.
"John?"
John blinked and looked down the table to see Avery Johnson leaning back in his chair, tugging at his mustache and appearing expectant.
"Sorry, Sergeant," he said.
"I didn't realize I had missed something."
"Relax, son. You didn't miss anything."
John was really beginning to hate that, being called son. But nothing good would come of complaining about it. They would probably just dismiss him as a moody teenager. He swallowed his irritation and sat a little straighter in his chair.
"What can I do for you, Sergeant?"
"Why don't you tell us what you think?" Johnson said. "You were in the thick of things, same as me. Did it seem like they were expecting us?"
"Not us," John said.
He wasn't sure what to make of the prodding. Was Johnson still feeling sorry for him? Or trying to give him a chance to win Ascot's confidence?
They had to realize they couldn't win. If they had known we were coming, they would have been long gone when we arrived. Only Johnson's eyes did not light with realization. He was infantry. He understood what happened when someone started a fight they couldn't win. They got killed.
"But you know that as well as I do, Sergeant."
Johnson shrugged. "Never hurts to confirm your range."
It was an old sniper saying, a reminder to check your assumptions before taking the shot.
"You seem certain of your assessment, John."
Crowther sounded more intrigued than challenging.
"But maybe the enemy thought they could win."
John shook his head. "Sorry, sir, but no. If they had built the bunkers to defend against us, they would have had to know we were coming before we entered slipspace, and if they had that kind of intelligence, they would have known we were coming heavy and they were going to die. So why stay?"
"I'm afraid I have to agree with John on this, sir," Ham said reluctantly.
She did not quite sound like she was in physical pain, but close. "They had nothing to gain by staying." Crowther nodded, but kept his attention fixed on John. "Go on, son." John let out a breath, then continued, "What if they were waiting for someone else?" Crowther nodded more vigorously.
"That makes sense," he said. "The rebels we captured yesterday are from all over. Eridanus Secundus, Jericho 7, Venezia, even Reach. Maybe they were waiting for more reinforcements."
"Yeah," Nayeto said, "like maybe from Gao."
"Gao?" Ascot asked.
"Isn't that where you're from?"
"That's right," Nayeto said. "Place is filthy with insurrectionists."
"So what are they doing on Sayoba?" Halsey's question had a rhetorical ring to it. "Not the Gaos in particular, all of them."
"This is bad."
Johnson was no longer leaning back in his chair. In fact, he looked like he was about ready to spring out of it.
It's the coup attempt. The insurrectionists are unifying their command.
The officers exchanged uneasy glances, and Nieto seemed more shaken than anyone, with a queasy expression and beads of sweat forming on his brow.
But they've got to know the aliens are glassing Etelan.
As Nieto spoke, a terrible thought, an unbelievable possibility, was forming in John's mind.
Why take Biko when it's next—
Wait, John said. I know who the innies were expecting. All eyes turned toward him, and Crowther said, How long are you going to keep us in suspense, son? John frowned.
I wish— You'd all stop calling me son.
He caught himself, then said, Never mind. They were expecting the Covenant.
They were going to ambush—
Crowther stopped in mid-sentence, and his brow rose in astonishment.
No. They were going to meet the aliens?
That's my guess. John was beginning to think he might have a chance of winning over Crowther after all. It explains why they're mounting a coup attempt at such a bad time. Surrendering Biko to the Covenant is the only way to save it, and overthrowing the Chancellor is the only way to surrender it.
And what if it isn't surrendering? Asgard asked. What if it's an offer?
An offer? Said Crowther.
Exactly, Asgard said. We're here because we know that if the aliens bypass Biko, they're leaving an operating base in their rear. We can also assume their logistics lines are getting pretty long, so they could use a staging base of their own. What if the insurrectionists are trying to strike a deal to give it to them?
John went cold inside. Who would do that? He asked. Who would form an alliance against their own species?
Maybe the insurrectionists don't see it that way, Johnson said. Maybe they see it as saving themselves from us.
That's crazy, Ham said. The Covenant will butcher them same as the rest of us.
Agreed, John said. But would they know that?
Crowther shook his head, then pointed a finger at John.
You're right, son, he said. They wouldn't. Son.
John gritted his teeth and said nothing. And an alliance would save them. For a while, Asgard added. If the aliens are as smart as we think, they'll know a good intelligence source when they see one. They'll milk it for as long as they can. A chill seemed to settle over the room, and their collective eyes dropped to the table as they considered what came next, contemplating the inescapable danger, and coming to the same terrible conclusion. At last, John said what everyone was thinking. If we're right about this, the alien delegation must be coming soon. He paused to swallow, then continued, And we need to ambush it. We need to make the Covenant think the insurrectionists set them up. The nodding in agreement started at the other end of the table with Ham, then Johnson, and down the far side of the table, Crowther, Asgard, and Halsey, and finally Nieto, who said,
You know what that will mean for Biko, right? They'll glass it in retaliation.
They'll glass it anyway when they're ready, Asgard said. And until they are, the rebels will be helping them glass one loyal world after another.
It's a simple equation, Halsey said. One world now, or 100 later.
Then we go with John's suggestion, Asgard said. We ambush the Covenant delegation.
With one proviso, Crowther said. We can't abandon the original operation. We divide our force and still board the fleet.
Of course, Asgard said, rising. That goes without saying. When Crowther smiled and started to get up, John saw his chance and also stood.
Colonel Crowther, he said, you're going to—
John stopped as a chorus of high-pitched alarms began to chirp from the tac pads everyone wore on their wrists. He glanced at his own and felt his throat go dry. Vanishing point reports, Covenant flotilla inbound, 5 vessels corvette class equivalent, ETA 22 minutes.
Damn, Avery Johnson said. That's some delegation.
And not one I want catching us on the surface. Asgard started around the table, already speaking into her tacpad microphone. Load all prowlers and scramble. 17-minute maximum.
Naito and Johnson turned to follow her out the door, but Crowther remained where he was, regarding John with a cocked brow.
You had something to say, John?
John glanced at Halsey, then swallowed hard and nodded.
Yes, sir. You're going to need all the black daggers you can get for the boarding action, and the Yalian ambush would be the perfect assignment for the Spartans.
It's quite true, Colonel, Halsey said. This is exactly the sort of thing I created them for.
Crowther shot her an uncomfortable frown, then started around the opposite end of the table toward John.
I appreciate the offer, son, he said, but you're 15.
John's heart sank, and he had to let his chin drop as he watched Crowther approach.
I understand, sir.
Crowther stopped a step away, looking for a moment as though he wanted to reach up to lay a hand on John's shoulder, then seemed to realize how awkward that would be and simply motioned him to follow.
Besides, I have another assignment for the Spartans.
Of course, sir.
John knew better than to hope it would be important. Crowther probably wanted them to carry his bags or something.
Whatever you need.
I knew I could count on you.
They reached the assembly chamber door, and Crowther turned to face John.
When we took the quarry yesterday, we captured more than 300 insurrectionists.
You want my Spartans to babysit prisoners, sir?
Crowther allowed himself a small grin.
I was going to say guard, he replied, but look at it however you like. As long as you get them all loaded aboard an internment transport. We can't have any falling into Covenant hands. The last thing we want is someone telling the enemy what really happened here. Is that clear?
Yes, sir, John said.
I think we can handle it.
I'm sure you can, son,
Crowther said.
I'll ask Captain Ascot to assign a prisoner transport.
Very good.
John raised his hand to salute, then said, Colonel Crowther,
with all due respect, sir,
I'd like to make a request.
What is it?
Please stop calling me son, John said. I've been a soldier for so long I can't even remember what my father looked like. But I'm pretty sure you aren't him.
Crowther's eyes went wide. Then he nodded.
Very well, Spartan. Consider it done.
He raised a hand and returned John's salute.
I think you've earned that much.
Chapter 12. Ninth Age of Reclamation, 34th Cycle, 41 Units. Covenant Battle Calendar. Bloodstar Flotilla, Intrusion Corvette Sacred Whisper, Orbital Approach, Third Moon, Planet Borodan, Chiral System.
They looked like moolegs leaping from the head of a bald human, those dark specks rising from the surface of the pale moon the humans called Saoba.
Silhouetted against the pink disk of the planet Borodan, they rose in singles and pairs and arced away, so tiny and swift that it was easy to think they were a trick of the eye. But after watching five of them vanish into nothingness in as many units, Tel Zatulain knew what he was seeing. Enemy vessels, departing the site of his rendezvous with the human traitors.
Zatulai remained in the forward observation blister, noting how his mandibles had begun to clench and the way his two hearts now pounded in counterpoint. Such responses were unworthy of a first blade of the Silent Shadow, and he could not even say whether they rose from fear or anger. He would meditate on this failure later, riding the spine of the ship in his contemplation sphere. But for now, it was enough to perceive the reactions and give them their space. That would quell the power of his control-hungry emotions and leave him free to focus, which he now felt prepared to do.
Without looking away from the observation blister, Zatulai rattled his mandibles to draw the crew's attention, then spoke in a gentle tone.
Summon the shipmaster.
The bridge of the Sacred Whisper quieted. Zatulai heard his order repeated four times as it was passed back to the shipmaster. Then a set of footsteps began to click up the deck toward his position. The gait was easy and confident, and Zatulai was troubled by that. Given the failure of the sensor readers to report the five, Now 6 vessel launches that he had watched with his own eyes. The shipmaster should have been ashamed of his crew's performance and fearful of the consequences. Perhaps the fault lay with Zadulai himself. A common, though incorrect, belief held that a member of the Silent Shadow would not kill a fellow Sangheili who had looked into his eyes. Thinking that the crew of his new flagship would perform better if they felt secure in his presence, Zadulai had chosen to play to their superstition by not wearing his helmet aboard the Sacred Whisper. And now, here was the shipmaster himself, approaching in complacence despite the shortcomings of his crew. Zadulai hoped it had not been a mistake to put everyone on board at ease. He would meditate on that as well. The shipmaster paused at the threshold of the observation blister and started a polite mandible rattle to draw attention to his presence, then let out a hiss of surprise as a 7th speck rose and arced away from Saoba.
"What is that?"
Zadulai turned to face the shipmaster.
"What does it look like, Budiasi?"
"An enemy vessel."
A stocky, block-faced Sangheili with blunt-ended mandibles. Hulan Budiasi was half again Zadulai's 60 years, and almost twice his girth.
"But there has been no report from the readers."
"It is good that you perceive the problem," Zadulai said.
"I am not sure your second is ready to assume command."
Budiasi's eyes bulged, and he turned back toward the bridge.
"Summon Gusoni and Terib."
Zadulai silenced Budiasi with a touch.
"Will we learn more by bringing the readers to us, or by going to their station?"
"Going to their station," Budiasi replied. "If the problem is in their equipment, I will see it there."
"Then let us proceed wisely," Zadulai said. "I am not some Sanshayum minister who must be served before our cause."
Budiasi's mandibles parted in shock, though the way his head canted suggested he was not quite sure whether Zadulai had meant to slur their Sanshayum leaders or honor them. After a breath, he managed to close his mandibles and turn toward the rear of the bridge.
"As you prefer, Blade Master."
The shipmaster led the way through a maze of control consoles and equipment stands to the back of the bridge, where a tactical hologram of Saoba's side of the Borodan planetary system floated above a projection pad surrounded by 10 data collection lecterns. At each lectern stood a reader, his eyes focused on a crystal display screen filled with a melange of alphanumeric codes and vector symbols that they used to plot images on the hologram. Behind the readers were the two obedientaries who oversaw the plotting operation. Normally they would be standing opposite one another, each supervising a team of 5 readers. But Budiasi's aborted summons had brought them together to discuss what kind of trouble they might have fallen into. Budiasi went straight to the obedientaries and began questioning them about unreported vessels fleeing Saoba. Zadulai circled the tactical hologram, occasionally peering over a reader's shoulder at his display screen, but mostly pondering the thousands of images the hologram did contain. Borodan itself was surrounded by a shell of orbital traffic, thousands of satellites, hundreds of vessels, both military and civilian, dozens of manufacturing stations, and a handful of shipyards. A steady stream of cargo drones moved between the manufacturing stations and the 2 metal-heavy moons currently on the Whisper's side of the planet, and several passenger ships were climbing out of its gravity well in preparation for transition to slipspace. But aside from a shell of reconnaissance boats in ultra-high picket orbits and a few dozen large military vessels waiting in rapid-response geosynchronous orbits, Zadulai saw no sign that the humans were preparing for battle. And he saw nothing moving toward Saoba. That was to be expected, or at least hoped for. Even the Covenant's best masking systems were only about 80% effective, so there was always the possibility of detection. But Zadulai's small flotilla of intrusion corvettes had emerged from slipspace, well beyond detection range, and engaged active camouflage long before approaching the picket orbits. So he saw no reason to believe the situation at Borodan was anything but what it appeared. A world aware that an attack by a superior force might be imminent, but choosing to believe it would not come. Only the steady stream of vessels rising from Saoba, from the designated rendezvous site, gave him pause. It looked to Zatalai as if they might be reacting to the approach of his flotilla. But they were not turning to engage, and neither were any of the military vessels in the rapid response orbits above Borodan. It made no sense. Had the humans known about his flotilla, they would be sending a force to meet it. He needed to know more, something about the vessels fleeing Saoba. It was the only way to solve this riddle. When he looked over the reader's shoulder at the seventh data collection lectern, Zatulai finally found the display screen that showed Saoba. He could see several data codes creeping along the edge of the screen, where the moon's bulk did not block the planet's face, but there were no codes near Saoba itself. Indeed, the moon appeared empty, which was exactly what had been reported by the information harvesters in the Sacred Whispers eavesdropping contra. "Why is there no data for this moon?" Zatalai asked. The reader dropped his gaze in a gesture of submission, then replied, "There is data, Blademaster. A great deal." "Then why does your screen show nothing moving on the moon or away from it?" "Because there is nothing to show," the reader replied. "It has been deserted for 100 human years, just as the harvesters reported." Zatalai heard Boudiassi hurrying over with the two obedientaries, and without looking away from the lectern, he raised a hand to stop them. Their presence would be intimidating, and in eagerness to please his superiors, the young reader would grow reluctant to speak unpleasant truths. "Tell me about this data that shows nothing," Zatalai said. "Tell me how you know it is nothing." "As you command." The reader touched the screen in two places. The moon grew indigo blue, though there was a notch on the horizon where it paled to merely deep blue. The color shows the ambient temperature on the moon's surface. The closer to black, the colder. Zatalai touched a finger to the notch. "And why is it paler there?" "That is the ice quarry where we are bound," the reader explained. "The paler hue indicates that it is a few units warmer." Zatalai sensed a knot of anger forming between his hearts. He took an instant to acknowledge it and rob it of power, then pointed at the tactical holograph in front of them. "And why did you not think to plot this?"
"It would have been misleading."
The reader's voice scratched with fear. "The readings suggest the month-old impact of a small comet or asteroid more than they do a vessel. And I found no wave radiation or magnetic readings that supported the possibility of even a small vessel."
"Ask Utu Ghassani to confirm."
Zatalai raised a hand. "You have nothing to fear. I only wish to know your reasoning, yes?" The reader relaxed and pointed his mandibles up to the right, indicating he understood. "You know why we are traveling to the ice quarry?" Zatalai asked. Their exact destination and the purpose of their trip were supposed to remain unknown to the crew. But in the confines of a bridge, it was often difficult not to overhear and still perform one's duties. "Be truthful."
"I have heard it is to rendezvous with a human spy."
"Close enough." "And yet you did not consider the possibility that the heat signature was made by the spy's vessel?" The reader dropped his mandibles to the left, indicating he had not.
"I should not have had that knowledge," he said, "and even knowing it, the signature does not support such a conclusion. If there is a vessel waiting for us in the quarry, it must be hidden beneath 30.
Realizing his mistake, the reader let the statement trail off.
"My error, Blademaster."
The reader's nostrils quivered with fear.
"There could be a vessel waiting inside a deep cave system. That would explain the low temperature variation and lack of support readings."
"One vessel or many?"
"Many, if the cave system was large enough."
Zatalai pointed at the screen again. "What if I were to tell you that at least 7 vessels have launched from that moon even as we approach?"
"That is impossible," the reader said. "The thermal blossom would have been difficult to miss. And if they were human spacecraft,
There would have been magnetic fluctuations and electromagnetic emissions.
What if I were to tell you that I witnessed those launches with my own eyes?
Zatalai allowed his voice to sharpen.
And that there is nothing wrong with my eyes.
The reader's mandibles fluttered. Then he spoke in a dry voice.
I would conclude that the impossible has occurred.
How wise you are, for one so young.
Zatalai looked over and motioned Budiasi to approach with the two obedientaries.
Now, let us imagine how the impossible would occur.
A cloaking field, suggested one of the obedientaries, Ghassani. I know that Muddawat Pathworks is attempting to develop an energy barrier for its frigates that conceals as well as protects. Perhaps the humans have an emplaced version.
The humans have no manner of energy barrier, Zatalai interrupted. And even if they did, a cloaking field does not explain why their vessels are invisible to our launch readers after they...
Leaving the word launch unspoken, Zatalai turned to the reader.
If it were the sacred whisper rising from a quarry, how bright would the thermoblossom be?
Not very bright, the reader replied. Our repulsor engines produce only a small amount of heat, so there would be only a red flare that lasted but a moment before vanishing.
Brighter than what you are seeing now?
Far brighter, Blademaster.
If the humans are launching anything, it is but a shadow compared to the sacred whisper.
Zatalai was thunderstruck by the sudden realization, and immediately pummeled by a wave of nausea, swift and powerful. It spread through his body like a fever. He found himself warm and almost trembling, his knees and hands and the nostrils beneath his eyes prickling with shock. It was unthinkable that human stealth craft could be superior to those in his flotilla. And yet, here it was, the simplest explanation. The only explanation.
Zatalai turned to Budiasi. We need to take down one of those shadow vessels. Open fire.
At this range, we would be lucky to hit the moon, much less a target we cannot even detect.
You can identify the ice quarry, can you not?
Zatalai felt his heart's hammering and knew his astonishment was turning to anger, but he did not know how many shadow vessels remained to launch, and time was short.
Target that.
If we open fire,
Budiasi said, we won't be able to keep our rendezvous with the human traitors. The attack will reveal our presence.
The humans already know of our presence, Zatalai said.
There are no traitors on that moon to welcome us. Perhaps these Spartans they spoke of are not even real. The entire rendezvous is a trap.
Budiasi's nostrils flared wide. So did those of the obedientaries and the reader. No one moved or spoke.
I gave an order, Zatalai said. He allowed his hand to drift toward the energy sword clipped to the waist of his armor. So if you continue in this defiance...
Caution is not defiance.
As Budiasi spoke, he refused to let his gaze drop to Zatalai's sword hand. An act of will that spoke to his courage. He knew that what he said next might cost him his life, yet he would utter it nevertheless, as was his duty.
We are a lightly armed intrusion force, not a battle fleet. If we allow the humans to engage, we will be destroyed.
Then the Kaid will have to work fast.
Zatalai moved his hand away from his sword hilt and turned toward the gravity lift at the rear of the bridge.
Do not question me on this again, shipmaster. Those shadow vessels are a danger to the fleet, and I will have one to examine.
Chapter 13 0847 hours, March 19th, 2526, Military Calendar. Subsurface Maintenance Grotto 6M430, Seoba Ice Quarry, Moon Seoba, Biko Planetary System, Kolakoa System. Over the years, John 117 had been paraded before enough admirals and generals to know one when he saw one.
and the tall prisoner with the gray shirt and starched collar was definitely a general. The man's spine was so straight it looked like a Series 99 sniper barrel, and he was surrounded by a half-dozen even taller insurrectionists who kept shifting around, trying to shield him from their Mjolnir-armored babysitters. Concealing their leader had been simple enough when the Spartans arrived to find 300 captives packed into the center of a cold and murky maintenance grotto. But now that the prisoners were being marched up a brightly lit loading ramp into the troop hold of a Banta-class transport that had belonged to the United Rebel Front only hours earlier, their efforts to hide the suspected general were obvious. The Covenant ETA was 10 minutes, barely enough time to get the transport loaded and away. The plan was to have one of Hector Nieto's backup flight crews deliver the insurrectionist prisoners to Biko in one of their own transports, where they would be remanded to the colonial authority for judicial disposition. But John knew his superiors would want a general held back for Oni interrogation. He stepped to the bottom corner of the loading ramp and spoke through his helmet's external speakers. "Prisoners, halt!" The embarking column shuffled to an uneasy standstill with the imprecision of irregular soldiers everywhere, and the companions of the suspected general left him unshielded for a full second and a half. John took advantage of their sloppiness to store the image of a slender-faced man with salt-and-pepper hair and eyes the color of gun steel. Before the request had actually formed in John's mind, the Mjolnir's onboard computer displayed the subject's identity on the HUD. Former Major General Harper Garvin, UNSC Marine Corps deserter, suspected terrorist, United Rebel Front High Command, target priority CNK-2A. The target priority flashed red, telling John that Oni wanted Garvin captured but not killed, which suggested it was more important to interrogate him than to remove him from the battlefield. It was a common designation for those second or third in command of an insurrectionist organization. The 2A meant that the general's capture did not take priority over an ongoing mission. So Garvin was an important figure in the United Rebel Front, but not the most important. The 2A designation also meant the operative's safety was not a consideration in executing a capture attempt. Welcome to Special Ops. After the target priority stopped flashing, the general's file began to scroll down the HUD, listing attributed operations and possible sightings. John wasn't interested, so the onboard computer advanced the file until it reached Garvin's most recent post in the UNSC. The general had deserted after receiving a 2-year billet teaching logistics at the Corbulo Academy of Military Science on Cercinius IV. The assignment had been a humble one for a major general, and there was speculation that he had joined the insurrection to retaliate. The theory sounded a bit far-fetched to John. But then again, generals didn't get to be generals by having small egos. "Spartan leader, what's the holdup?" The leader of Gold Team, Joshua 029, was using Squadcom, a channel open to all 12 Spartans on Task Force Yama. "I thought we wanted to get these prisoners out of here before the aliens arrived." "Spotted one we need to hold for Oni," John said. He switched back to his external speaker and pointed at Garvin. "You there. Present yourself for inspection." The cluster of bodies surrounding Garvin milled about and tried to look confused. Meanwhile, the Spartans flanking the column stepped back and checked their spacing, ready to respond if the order drew any resistance from the prisoners. "Even on Sayoba, this armor weighs..." John paused until the onboard computer displayed the number on his HUD. 56 kilograms. "If I have to wade through the column to retrieve you, there will be a lot of broken toes." The cluster rippled. Then a thin, olive-skinned woman emerged and began pushing her way toward John. She had a broad mouth, bright blue eyes, and a mocking smirk. John gave her a quick appraisal, checking for the possibility of a bomb or other undetected weapon, then motioned her to stop at the bottom of the loading ramp. "What are you doing?"
"Preparing myself as ordered."
The woman craned her neck to look up at his faceplate.
"But I got to warn you, I'm not into robots."
A chorus of nervous chuckles. "I'm not a robot," John said.
"Sorry, big boy," the woman said. "You want me to believe that?
You gotta lose the armor. More laughter. Kelly 087's voice sounded over squadcom.
John, that's not real flirting. She's trying to distract me, affirmative.
He looked back toward the cluster of prisoners shielding Garvin. Of course, the general had vanished into their midst. Deciding to use the robot image to his advantage, John said, "All teams, stand ready." The Spartans brought their assault rifles up. John lashed out. Before the woman could react, her tunic lapels were knotted inside his gauntlet.
"John, do you need assistance?"
This from Kurt 051, the leader of Green Team.
"I don't see the threat."
Rather than waste one of the 8 minutes remaining before the Covenant arrived, John ignored him and spoke through his external helmet speaker.
"The UNSC Military Code of Conduct authorizes the summary execution of any prisoner interfering with a guard while on the field of combat. As you were engaged in an ongoing effort to conceal the presence of General Harper Garvin from the imprisoning authority, let her go, soldier."
Garvin emerged from the back of the transport, and pushing past a crowd of insurrectionists who were trying to block his way, started down the ramp. His gaze dropped to the woman in front of John.
"Thanks for trying, Petora. But we never stood a chance against those things."
John waited until Garvin had presented himself at the bottom of the ramp, then released the woman. "The prisoners will resume loading." When the insurrectionists were slow to obey, Garvin looked over his shoulder.
"Don't give them an excuse, people."
Once the embarkation column had started up the ramp again, he turned back to John.
"How did you identify me, soldier?"
Seizing the initiative was a classic counter-interrogation technique, one that John's instructors on Reach had hammered home when he was 10 years old. Rather than go with the standard response of ordering the prisoner to shut up, which would tell Garvin only a little less about the Spartan training program than an honest answer, John checked the general's personnel file on his HUD and selected something misleading. "In 2508, you lectured on quelling planetary insurrections at Luna OCS." John had not even been born in that year, so the misinformation would cause Garvin nothing but trouble if he tried to use it later. It was memorable. Garvin's brow rose.
"You were a student there."
"You ask a lot of questions, General." John checked the chronometer on his HUD. The ETA was now 7 minutes. "Let's just say I was disappointed you turned traitor." The Major General's lips tightened, and his gaze slid away.
"As you like, soldier. I'm in your—"
The last few words of the sentence were swallowed by the deafening rumble of an artillery strike. Then the air was filled with ice flakes fluttering down from the darkness above. Another rumble shook the grotto, and ice blocks began to tumble down from the ceiling and bounce off heads and shoulders. Several prisoners were struck and fell to the ground, clearly injured. Ascot's voice came over the Task Force Yama command channel.
"Launch! Launch! Launch! Emergency protocol! The aliens have opened fire! Repeat! Emergency protocol! Launch!"
The transmission ended in a crash of static, and a constant growl filled the grotto as distant strikes began to shudder through the surrounding ice. As the static faded, a cacophony of chatter filled the void left by Ascot's absence, but Nieto's voice stood out.
"Starry Knight was hit on launch and downed."
That would be Ascot's prowler.
"Intact. She dropped in the quarry—"
Crowther's calm voice cut in.
"Thank you, Commander. That's enough for now. We'll advise if we need more information."
"We'll advise?"
Nieto sounded livid.
"They could be alive. They could need—"
"We'll do what we can, Commander," Crowther said. "Please proceed as planned and use Protocol Echo for all communications."
Protocol Echo was an instruction to regard a communication mode as non-secure. In this case, Crowther seemed to be reminding Nieto, and everyone else on the channel, that the extent of Covenant eavesdropping capabilities was unknown, so it was safer to assume that even encrypted comm channels were compromised. John thought the precaution was probably overkill, but the colonel had a point. There was no sense in taking unnecessary chances. The discussion on the command channel continued in a guarded manner, with references to direction and location relayed in terms relative to the ice caves, where the prowler wing had been berthing when the scramble order came. John listened with one ear, in case the Spartans were given a new assignment, but stayed focused on the prisoners. The insurrectionists were holding their arms over their heads to protect themselves from falling ice blocks, and many were eyeing their injured comrades with worried looks. "Grab your wounded and load up," John ordered over his helmet's external speaker. "Anyone not aboard the transport in 1 minute dies here." The prisoners broke into action, grabbing their hurt companions and ascending the loading ramp into the Banta's troop hold. The internal hatches had been secured from the other side, and the emergency escape pods could only be armed from the flight deck, so there was little chance of any rebels mounting another escape attempt from inside the vessel. They would be going nowhere but Biko, where they would face the consequences of their planned coup. Garvin dodged an ice block as it bounced off John's armor, then cast a concerned look into the darkness above. "What's happening?" "The aliens opened fire," John said. On the command channel, Crowther was asking for a response from the Starry Knight and receiving none, which could indicate anything from the Prowler's destruction to a disabled antenna. "Guess they weren't interested in making friends with you after all." Garvin's eyes widened.
"So that's what you're doing here," he said.
"How did you know?"
"Dumb question."
John knew a non-answer would leave Garvin's imagination running wild and make him an easier target for the interrogation team later. "How do you think Oni knew where to find Colonel Watts?" Garvin's face went pale. Now Crowther was asking about availability, trying to find a Black Dagger unit in position to reach the downed Prowler. He wasn't receiving any positive responses. Most of the 21st had departed before the alien barrage started, and the final company had launched aboard the four Prowlers of Ascot's own night flight. The survivors were eager to assist, but they would be forced to turn back into a plasma barrage that was growing more intense by the moment. "Negative," Crowther said over the command channel. "The last thing we need is more bats down." From what John was hearing, the only unit still in position to check on the Starry Knight's status was his own squad of Spartans. Responding to the crash site would mean leaving the prisoners locked inside the Banta's troop hold without guards. But a breakout would be impossible. All Nayedo's flight crew had to do was depressurize everything between the troop hold and the flight deck. The biggest drawback was that Garvin wasn't wearing a pressure suit, so John couldn't take him along on the rescue attempt. Instead, the general would have to remain with the other prisoners and go to Biko. With any luck, Oni would be able to extract the general before the colonial authority executed him. But even if that didn't happen, the thought of a Prowler falling into Covenant hands was a far more troubling possibility. John pointed Garvin up the loading ramp. "Go join your people."
"What?"
Garvin looked confused for a second, then narrowed his eyes.
"Wait. You can't let us launch into an alien now."
John grabbed a fistful of shirt and tossed him up the ramp into the troop hold. "Enjoy Biko, General." He calmed Nayeto's flight crew. "Sierra 117 to Banta Transport," he said. Sierra was a comm code for Spartan. "Change of plans. You're on your own."
"No way."
The pilot seemed almost panicked.
"You can't send us up without an onboard escort."
"I can and I am."
John was puzzled by the alarm in the woman's voice. She had already been informed that the hold hatches were secured from the outside, and any military pilot who had been through even a basic ship security course would realize that all she had to do to secure the bridge was depressurize the main cabin. "Just follow flight deck isolation protocols. You'll be fine."
"But Commander Nayeto wanted you—"
"Not going to happen," John said. "We're the only unit available to go after Captain Ascot and the Starry Knight. Have a good trip." John closed the channel, then motioned for his 11 Spartans to follow him toward the airlock. He didn't contact Crowther because that would only be putting the colonel in a bad spot, forcing him to choose between abandoning a downed Prowler and violating military law by sending 15-year-olds into harm's way. Given the colonel's tendency to cover his own ass first, it seemed pretty clear he would abandon the Prowler.
"Okay, I'll ask."
It was Joshua 029, speaking over Squadcom. "What are we doing?"
"Going after the Starry Knight."
"Funny," Kurt 051 said. "I didn't hear Colonel Crowther authorize that."
"He didn't need to,"
John said. We're all that's left.
Maybe so, Kelly said, but we're still going to need a ride out of here when we're done.
She had a point, but John wasn't sure how to handle things. If he asked Crowther for permission to respond to the Starry Night, the Prowler's crew would be abandoned, and any survivors left to their fates. But Kurt and Joshua were right to be concerned. This kind of rescue operation required coordination, and undertaking it without informing the rest of the task force would expose his people to a lot of unnecessary risk. It would have been nice to have Avery Johnson here to consult, but he'd disappeared right after the debriefing. Maybe he didn't like working with 15-year-olds either. "Let's see what we see," John said. "The first thing he'll want is a sit-rep." They proceeded to the maintenance grotto's access vestibule, an oversized airlock that opened into the bottom of the vast quarry pit. The crew chamber was more than large enough to hold 12 Spartans, so John led the squad inside and sealed the inner hatch. Crowther was going to be pissed, but lives were at stake, and so was any high-risk intel aboard the Prowler. If the Covenant captured Task Force Yama's mission plan, it'd be the end of Silent Storm. If they captured Earth's coordinates, it would mean the end of the human species. The priorities were clear. John had to go after Halima Ascot and the Starry Night.
Chapter 14 0859 hours, March 19th, 2526, Military Calendar. Exterior Maintenance Yard, Saoba Ice Quarry. Moon Saoba. Biko Planetary System, Kolakoa System. John stepped out of the airlock into sublimation fog so thick he could barely see the end of his assault rifle. The clouds overhead were flashing bright with the constant arrival of plasma bolts, and it felt like walking into the heart of a thunderstorm. He led his squad of Spartans 30 meters forward, far enough from the quarry walls to escape the unending cascade of ice tumbling down from above, then stopped. John opened the command channel. Sierra 117 requesting waypoint to target location. If the rest of the task force was following standard rescue protocol, and John felt sure they would be, one of the surviving prowlers would be on station above Saoba, monitoring the surface situation via signal intercepts and tactical drones. They would know the locations of all 12 members of his squad from their identification friend or foe codes. Most importantly, they would be able to guide the Spartans toward the Starry Night's crash site. Able, but possibly unwilling. Crowther's voice came over the channel.
What do you think you're doing, so...
Blue Leader? The colonel's tone wasn't entirely hostile, which John decided to take as a tacit authorization of his plan. We're checking Starry Night's status, sir. We seem to be the only unit available. John thought Avery Johnson would be proud of his tact. He was answering Crowther in a way that gave him plenty of cover. The Spartans were undertaking the assignment without asking for permission, so the colonel could easily deflect blame if something went wrong. Besides, there wasn't any choice. The Spartans really were the only unit available. John signaled his team leaders, Kurt 051 and Joshua 029, to deploy in a search line. That would create a 100-meter-wide rank of Mjolnir-armored Spartans, with the 4 members of Green Team spaced every 10 meters on the left flank, and the 4 members of Gold Team spaced every 10 meters on the right flank. Blue Team and its 4 members would remain in the center, gathered more tightly, so he would have a ready reaction force. When Crowther still hadn't replied, John signaled the squad to advance at a trot, heading more or less away from the dockyards where Alpha Company had suffered so many casualties. Over the command channel, he said, "We'll take a look and report."
"Affirmative."
Crowther sounded relieved.
"But take action only if immediately warranted. Biko is responding to the plasma barrage in force. Commander Nieto assures me the alien flotilla will be destroyed or in retreat within the hour."
"More or less," Nieto added. "But don't worry, Spartan. We've got your backs down there."
"Acknowledged." John hoped he sounded more impressed than he was. He liked Nieto and truly appreciated his support. But in his experience so far, when the lieutenant commander told him not to worry, it was time to start thinking the opposite.
Besides that, John knew humanity's track record all too well. Even if the local naval forces outnumbered the flotilla 3-1, the alien ships were resilient and dangerous enough to nullify the advantage of superior numbers. I'll keep that in mind. A waypoint appeared on John's HUD, pointing about 30 degrees to the right of dead center.